Welcome to Let's Talk. I'd like to acknowledge the continuing sovereignty of all First Nations peoples across the country. I'd also like to acknowledge traditional owners. I'd also like to acknowledge elders, elders of the First Peoples of the land, and elders of more recent arrivals. Welcome to each and every one of you. And welcome to all our listeners tuned in across the country by the National Indigenous Radio Service and across the world by the World Wide Web. Welcome to you. It's great to have your company. Well, let's hope you've had a great weekend. I certainly have. Beautiful weather. And what about today? Just magical. Blue sky, sunshine. And it's Sorry Day. National Sorry Day today. And we got news today that David Gulpilil has taken out Best Actor at Cannes Film Festival for his role in Charlie's Country. Charlie's Country is the third film by Rolf de Heer that David Gulpilil has acted in. And it's just great to see him acknowledged in Cannes. He may have been acknowledged there before, but there was no reference to it, so this may be the first time. But for Gulpilil to take out Best Actor for Charlie's Country is just fantastic. Well done. He's seen the highs, he's seen the lows, he's seen jail, he's seen his traditional country living very much in a traditional sense. So he's seen it all, David, over time. And it's really great to see that he's been acknowledged in this regard, in this way. My guest today, young Murray woman, Leanne Enoch, joining me live in the studio. Leanne, welcome to the studio. It's good to have you here.
Thank you. Good morning, everybody.
Now, you are currently a campaign officer with Queensland Council of Union, but you've just done a big stretch with Australian Red Cross.
Oh, yes, yeah. I was with Australian Red Cross for almost seven years and very recently just joined the Queensland Council of Unions, which is a great organisation, the peak body for all trade unions in Queensland.
Very good. And you're going to give us an update on the stolen wages campaign and Uncle Conrad Yateman's case that comes up on Wednesday in town, in court here. But before we get to there, tell us your mob, your country.
Yeah, so I'm a Noonuccal Noongi woman of the Quandamooka Nation, which takes in the waters and islands of Moreton Bay. So I'm originally from North Stradbroke Island, so I have ancestral ties into Moreton Island and North Stradbroke Island, but also into the far north where my grandmother was from, and she was a Kanju woman from up in the far north of Queensland.
Mm.
Yeah, so that's where I originally come from.
Mm. Where'd you grow up?
But I grew up in Woodridge, which we moved to the mainland pretty much when I started school, myself and then my younger brother, and then we had two more brothers join us when we moved to the mainland. So Woodridge State High School was the school that I went to, and I grew up in that community.
All right. Did you go on and do any university study, any of that sort of stuff?
Yeah, I was really lucky because my family were very committed to education, and I think both mum and dad, who is our Aboriginal parent, very committed to the idea of making sure that we all had a great education and that we could move amongst the rest of the society and make some difference. So I went on to become a high school teacher, and obviously the university degree that got me to that. I taught English and drama.
Did you really?
Yeah, so a little bit different.
Whereabouts?
Well, I started off in the north side of Brisbane and then went up to Gladstone for a few years. Just loved Gladstone. Beautiful people. A big shout out to all the Blackmans and Johnsons and all them up there in Gladstone. And then I had a chance to go over to the UK, to the United Kingdom, and I taught in an East London school for almost 4 years.
Really?
Yeah, hilarious. Aboriginal girl from North Stradbroke Island who grew up in Woodridge teaching English to the English. It was hilarious.
Oh, gee,
not that they speak English like we speak English, but it was quite interesting. Yeah.
What was it that got you to sort of want to go and work in the UK?
I think it was just, I just had this desire to have a look at other countries pretty early on in my career. And I think at that time my grandmother, my Aboriginal grandmother, had passed away after my first year of teaching. After my second year of teaching. And then something inside of me just said, you got to go and do these things. You've got to do these things because, you know, life is for living, get on with it. You know, if you've got a dream, go and chase it.
Don't die wondering what could have been or would have been.
Exactly, yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I just made that decision and spent a year saving money and just went, just took some time, what was going to be a year off from teaching, and literally just got on a plane, didn't go with anybody, didn't have a job to go to. Wasn't nobody over there that I knew, yeah. Nothing. Just knew that I had to go. And when I look back on it, I go, geez, that was really stupid. You must be cracked. Because, you know, it's a big thing to do by yourself when you've never been overseas before. You know, within a few days I got a job and I was right to go. I don't know, you know, when you just feel... Yeah, but you know, when you just feel like you're supposed to do something and you feel supported, you don't... Like, I never felt alone. I felt absolutely 100% supported, whether it was my grandmother,
Grandmother spirit with you.
Yeah, I just felt like it's what I had to do and I went and did that, so... But, you know, when you go overseas for a couple of years and then you come back and you have a look at your country...
Don't you appreciate it?
Yeah, and you see things differently.
Don't
you know?
What?
Yeah. And at that time, you know, John Howard was the Prime Minister and I came back to a country that I didn't really recognise anymore and that really upset me.
Mm.
So it wasn't long after coming back that I decided that I needed to move into more the policy area of education, which is what I did for a few years. I wanted to make a bigger difference. I wanted to get into the middle of where policy was to be able to make the most difference possible in the shortest period of time. And so, got the chance to move around in the policy areas and also into local government for a little while. So I worked in Brisbane City Council as their senior Indigenous policy officer, back into state government for a little while, and then Australian Red Cross called me and asked... if I'd like to come and do some work for them. And, you know, turned up into what was a pretty much a greenfield space and got to do some pretty interesting, innovative stuff there.
Robert Tickner, former Minister for Aboriginal Affairs, federal government. Mm. He was or is the CEO, but he was at that time.
Yeah, he's still the CEO of Red Cross, as far as I understand. So, but, you know, quite a very dedicated to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander affairs, obviously, which is why Red Cross headed down that path not long after he joined as the CEO.
Yeah, no, I first met him as a solicitor for the Aboriginal Legal Service in Redfern many, many years ago, and he goes on to become, to get elected as and become the member, federal member for Aboriginal Affairs. Yeah. When did you decide that politics, you actually wanted to, you talk about policy.
Yes.
And stuff like that, but politics themselves. You stood as a candidate for Coomera.
Yes, way back.
Two elections back ago.
Right.
And what, the last one, did you sit out or did you try again or anything?
Yeah, no, the last one, I think two elections ago, I had the great opportunity of running as a state running for the state seat. Huge learning experience, like massive learning experience. You know, it's so foreign to our communities in terms of that kind of level of politics. I mean, we see it in, we've seen politics and elected sort of political positions at a certain level, but this was new. There wasn't a lot of people I could call on to say, hey, have you done this before? Like, what's this mean? And all the rest of it. So great learning experience. I didn't have a go at the last election because I thought there was still some learning for me. You know, I wanted to be able to come back into a seat and be able to be the best possible candidate that particular electorate could have. So that's why I'm running this time. So I am now the Labor candidate, the endorsed Labor candidate for the seat of Alcester, which takes in suburbs of Brisbane from Forest Lake, Alcester and Parkinson, down to Hillcrest and Boronia Heights.
Why the change? Have you relocated and not living in that Coomera area? Why the change? You stood for Coomera a couple of years ago and now it's Alcester.
Yeah, well, I lived in Woodridge for quite some time and the Coomera opportunity came up and there weren't any local branch members that... and it was a brand-new electorate. So so I had the opportunity to move into that area and take on that challenge. But then I moved back into Logan City. And Alcester, because it takes in a large proportion of Alcester is in Logan, you know, there's an opportunity there. I've been working with the branch members in that area for a long time. And I'd been asked several times to come and be their candidate. And so I said yes, and this is where we're at.
What is it with the politics that you want to, that sort of seems to be inviting to you or an aspiration of yours? What is it? You obviously want to make some, want to be involved in making change and stuff.
I think when I was a really little girl, for your listeners, I'm a fair-skinned Murray, so my grandmother, from when I was very little, my Aboriginal grandmother, used to say to me all the time, oh, you can walk amongst them and they'll never know. And I didn't understand what she was talking about back then. I thought, what? But I'm just like everybody else in this family, you know? But as I've gotten older, I've kind of understood what she was trying to say to me. It's like, you know, I'm able to move in some of those circles and make big changes. And so that's why, for me, politics has come on the radar. It came on the radar when I was very young. I think when you live in a family full of activists, I mean, you know, Auntie Kath or Auntie Udru Nunuckle also ran for Labor in Greenslopes back in the 60s or 70s, early, late 60s, I think it was, early 70s. So, you know, you have those, you have that kind of activism around you all your life. You know that that's something that comes naturally.
Yes, like
you
want to be a natural.
That's
right. Yes.
And, you know, defending what is socially just and right is something that I think many Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people understand instinctively.
That's right.
So for me, the move into politics was really about all those factors, my instinctive need to be a part of, you know, making a socially just world, but also my desire to be part of in the hurly, you know, be in the middle of the hurly-burly of policy making and making as much difference as possible and walking amongst people, walking amongst them, as my grandmother used to say. So... yeah, so all of that combined, I think, has really pushed me in that area, and a lot of hard work ahead. You know, hard work to get elected for one thing, hard work to get pre-selected. Let me tell you,
really,
nobody hands you anything, you know. And I think I like it that way.
You go in and fight for everything.
Yeah, I like it that way. I don't like having anything handed to me.
No, no, you get it on your own merits and on your own endeavours and stuff.
That's right. Yeah. And I, you know, my dad in particular taught us that. You know, he never once put his hand out for welfare, never once sat back and, you know, let somebody else give him anything that he didn't already work for. Everything that he ever had, everything we ever had was built on his work ethic.
And he earned it.
Yeah, and that's how, you know, I think that's how I run my life too. But, yes, tough work to get pre-selected, hard work to be elected, need lots of help, lots of people.
Yes, a big support network
around you. Really need everybody to come out and help. But then, you know, if elected, and I hope I am, you know, I'll be the first Aboriginal woman in Queensland Parliament if that happens, then lots of work to actually keep in the hurly-burly of policy to make the changes and represent, you know, all people in the Alcester electorate, but to bring my unique perspectives as an Aboriginal woman into the Parliament and allow those perspectives to mould policy.
When you talk about you want to be involved in making things right and socially just, that's not just a black thing, is it?
No.
That's something right across the board.
Absolutely.
For everyone that calls this place home, regardless of racial background. It's not just a black thing. That's one of the big things that's different about us black fellas. We don't go in with a focus on, oh, this is just for me mob. I'm only representing me mob here. Or you know, we need access to land. Or we need better health. Or we need better education. It's not just a black thing, because there's spin-offs. There are benefits that flow on to settler society, mainstream Australia.
I couldn't agree more. And that's the thing. I think when you're contributing to a socially just and fair society, we all benefit. We all benefit from that, you know. And to have any group of people who are not treated in a socially just way or a fair way, really, you know, it diminishes all of us. So, you know, I couldn't agree more with you, Tiger, on that.
How do you feel when you look around you in a political perspective, the federal government, the proposed budget that they've handed down, that's is a shocker. The state government with some of the stuff that Campbell Newman's doing and stuff, like trying to open up mining and trying to dredge the Barrier Reef and all that sort of stuff. You know, and I see over the weekend the bank, the Dutch bank, due to a big get-up campaign, has gone in and said, we're not financing it, we're not involved. I mean, that's a major thing. I mean, GetUp, the stuff that GetUp do and pull off and achieve, that's a massive turnaround to have an international financier like the Deutsche Bank, I think it's called, say, no, we're not going to be a part of it.
People power.
It is. So, what do you see? How do you feel when you look at the federal government situation, state government situation, and then the black situation, First Nations peoples in this country? There's the constitutional recognition coming through. But some of these things I think are just they're white-fella driven. It's not black-fella driven. That, for example, recognition, constitutional recognition. How do you feel about things?
Yeah, I think, you know, and I've had a chance to talk to lots of people, non-Indigenous, Aboriginal, Torres Strait Islander, and, you know, everything in between, well, everything, every kind of person across the current electorate that I'm in, but, you know, just in my normal work. And I think the thing that upsets me at the moment is that what we're seeing is an attempt to remould the world that we live in to suit a particular ideology. You know, the idea that profits come before people, you know, it's just that's the kind of world that I think what we're seeing in our current governments, they're trying to create that, trying to push us into being more worried about what we have and what next door neighbour has than who we are. You know, that disturbs me a great deal. You know, and when we're seeing all kinds of policy come through that support that change in our world, everything from selling of assets, which is just, you know, you can go to anywhere in the world to see where government assets have been sold, particularly power assets. It's not worked anywhere. People are worse off in the end. The only people who benefit are those who, you know, have a financial stake in it. Mm. So that disturbs me a great deal, and I think that's why I've stayed with the Labor Party all this time, even though there's been a few, you know, falling off the horses kind of thing. For me, fundamentally, the values are about socially just and fair, you know, society where everybody gets a fair go. Nobody's left behind. I mean, the idea of co-payments for the Medicare, for instance, is just, you know, that is so disturbing on many levels.
Just ludicrous.
It is to think that there are families that will make a financial decision about the health of themselves or their children, you know, that I can't even imagine the stress that would put on any family. You know, everybody who's got little kids knows how many times you have to go to the doctor. It's just how it is. The idea that you have to think, well, will we eat this week, or will I take him to get his ear checked and get some medicine?
Exactly.
No, that's not. It's just not. It's not the world that I want to live in. And I think that's what everybody's saying, that they're worried about how we're changing as a society. These tangible things, you know, Medicare, the fuel excise, the selling of assets, the cutting of thousands of jobs. I mean, the unemployment in Queensland is, you know, the highest it's been in 10 years. The breaking of promises, you know, the feeling of you can't trust what people say means that there's always something going on behind.
Yeah.
And now in Queensland, we've got things like the CMC, you know, losing quite a lot of its teeth. The secrecy of donations from you know, what will be high end of town. We won't know. We won't know how many hundreds of thousands of dollars one company or one group of people might have donated to government.
That's what it can get to over the course of a year.
Yeah.
It's being changed from $1,000. Anything above $1,000
right.
has to be declared.
Yeah.
But they've opened it up to a little over $10,000 or $10,500 per person.
Yeah, well, that's the thing.
Per month, because over the course of a year, that can be in excess of $100,000.
Absolutely.
It's quite significant.
And we would never know. We will never know who donated that money. And if, in fact, that donation has had any impact on tenders that have been awarded or policies that have been created or legislation that's been created, we'll have no idea if those donations have had any impact.
Well, look at the current situation with Abbott's daughter, what you could call it White House Gate, I think, with that mess where she was awarded a $60,000 scholarship. There's a lot of...
That's
a lot of
right.
muddy water there, a lot of murky water around that situation.
And not to take away...
And there's donations from the chair of the board or one of those senior people in that organisation has been involved in lobbying and financial donations and things like that. So there's murky water there.
It is. And you know, I mean, I think none of us want to take away from the fact that that young woman... Mr. Abbott's daughter has had an achievement in her life, and you know,
it was based on merit based.
And that's good on her.
Yeah.
Good on her.
Of course.
However, I think the thing that really upsets everybody is that in one breath we hear, oh, universities, you know, will basically be able to set their own fees. That student loans, you know, you'll have to pay back at an interest rate that is just ridiculous. So it's saying, you know, in one breath we're hearing that students will be worse off because they'll end up with, you know, astronomical debt that they'll be paying off sooner and really, you know, working to pay debt off from their university studies. And then in the other breath we hear that, you know, our Prime Minister's daughter has received this scholarship and, you know. So it's not to take away from her, good on her, but it's the hypocrisy that sits inside those two sort of different... For you, you can have this, but over here this happens. And again, you know, it comes back to this question of how people feel about the world that they want to live in. People generally don't want to see that kind of discrimination or... delineation between groups of people. We don't want to see very, very rich and very, very poor in our country, you know?
When you did your university studies, was there a fee? Was there a hex around? I mean, you're a lot younger than myself. Was there a hex around then? Because back in my day, it was, I don't think, not that I ever went to university. I didn't ever aspire to. I had enough in high school. It just was a bad enough experience in high school. Year 10, and year 10, get out of here. Started work the next day in the sawmill. But when you went to uni, was there a fee involved and stuff and you had to sort of pay that off or what?
Yeah, well, fortunately... Would
you get a scholarship? What did you do?
The first couple of years of my university years, there was no fee. So I was one of the very...
One of the last.
Very the last,
like in that last era.
So in my last year of uni, the HECS came in.
All right.
So, I mean, I was out on the street with all the other students protesting HECS. You know, I still feel like, you know, education is something that we want all of our children, regardless of where you come from, regardless of how wealthy your parents might be or not. We want all of our children to have a quality education and to have, you know, opportunities to expand their education to whatever level, you know, to be able to make a huge impact in our society and to grow. But yeah, I had that last year of HECS fees that I didn't have to pay off for quite some years after. You know, you had to reach a threshold, and that's lucky because teachers weren't paid that great back.
Yeah, right.
So you know, you just come out into your new job, and it's like, okay. So I had a few years before I had to pay it all off, but I only had 1 year, thankfully.
Leanne, what changed back in that time? You started a university degree where it was free, no fees, and in your last year of that degree, things had changed and HECS was introduced. What were the broader changes that forced the need for people like yourself and every student from that day forward to have to pay a fee? What changed? How did they justify it? I've never been able to understand it.
Yeah, well,
why don't we have a free education system?
Yeah, well, I still ask that question, but I mean, I guess at that time, as a young student, you came to understand, or the argument that was being posed at the time was that, you know, Australia was a growing country, growing as in there more and more youth, and that the cost of that kind of free education at the university level was becoming impossible to maintain into the future. The same kind of arguments that we hear today about, forecasted budgets and how do we manage, you know, what we have now, how do we keep it, in some kind of, resemblance of what it is currently. How do we keep that 10 years from now or 20 years from now? So that certainly was the argument that was made back in those days. For me, I look at other countries, particularly in Europe, where they're doing everything they can to make sure that university study is free or incredibly affordable, because they understand how important it is to have well-educated residents and members of your society.
So. Well, I think Cuba has made massive turnarounds with education. Mm. I'm not all that well studied or up to date with things, but I've just hear and see and read a few things over the years, and Cuba stands out there, and it's a very small as far as economy goes and things like that, and our country, but they've made some massive change or improvements within education, and I can't state the statistics and what they've got, but from what I understand,
I think there are a few examples elsewhere where, you know, it's about what priorities there are for your country, you know. So for some countries, education is an absolute priority, and that's why the budget reflects that. What we're seeing in Queensland is, priorities around mining and, things like that.
And
development, that's right. So the budget reflects that, we want to sell assets, for instance. Mm. That's about, the story behind that is about development, really. So.
Let's say the next elections, you'll make the announcement to the first Murray or First Nations woman in the Queensland Parliament. What are some of the priorities? What are some of the things that are important to you that you will focus on in that term of government?
Mm. Well, right now, I guess one of the things that we're quite fortunate with in the Labor Party is that Anastasia Palaszczuk and other leaders of the Labor Party have made a concerted effort to make sure that we've got candidates this early prior to the election, prior to when the election's due.
Which is March or so next year?
Especially March next year. So,
could come early?
It could. We never know. You never know what's happening. I mean, wouldn't have predicted, member for Stafford, Chris Davis, resigning just recently, for instance. So, politics, like life, I mean, it's, move very quickly. Mm. And so have to be prepared. But we've been fortunate that we've got all of these candidates on the ground right now. One of the things that we're doing is not creating policy in a vacuum. We've had this opportunity to talk to people about the tangible issues in their lives. Everybody talks about cost of living. People are worried about, how am I going to pay the electricity bill? Mm. How am I going to pay the water bill? The fuel's going up. I haven't got a job, or I'm scared that my job will be gone. There's all these pressures that are being placed on families right now. So we get to talk about that with people. And like I've been saying throughout our bit of a chat now, we also get to talk about hearts and minds type stuff, how people want to see Queensland, what kind of Queensland they want to live in. So all of those conversations are giving us the chance to develop policy that is a true reflection of the people that we represent. For me, I'm involved in that process, and I'm very grateful to be involved in that process, because hopefully at the end of it we'll have policies that are, like I say, a true reflection of the electorate. But the other point to your question, I guess, is I understand that as a First Nations woman, as a Aboriginal woman, as a Quandamooka woman, that there'll be other pressures that will be placed on me if I am elected. For me, we've just seen some, as a Quandamooka woman, we've just seen some pretty horrendous practices happening between Quandamooka and the state government, where you know, mining on the island, and the relationship between that mining company and the state government has overruled some of the conversations, or even the ability to have a conversation with the state government. So for me, I want to see, I would hope that I would be able to influence our policies to ensure that we uphold Indigenous land use agreements, that we uphold our conversations and our relationships, and that we're honourable and dignified in the way that we conduct ourselves with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. So for me, that's a massive thing. Mm. There are other single issue items that obviously will come up, and stuff like stolen wages, and I think, you know, a really important conversation. But I have to say, Tiger, I'm not alone, because there is also an First Nations man or Aboriginal man that is running in the next state election as well. So Billy Gordon is running in the seat of Cook. Mm-hmm. So for the first time...
He stood in the last election as well, didn't
he? Well, he stood in the federal election for Leichhardt.
Yes,
and
he did
quite well. Mm-hmm. He did quite well. And we're really fortunate that we have him now running in the state seat of Cook. So, so the first time we've got, a First Nations woman and a First Nations man running as candidates for the Australian Labor Party in Queensland. So I know that if we are hoping that we both are successful.
Are they winnable?
I think Cook is very much
winnable.
You're
not being put into something where the you need a massive swing against the sitting member, you know, the current member. Are they winnable, you think?
Yeah, well, Cook is winnable. I think Billy is likely to win. I hope he is. I think he's on about 3%.
Mm-hmm.
But we have to understand that this is in the context of the massive swing that we had at the last state election. I mean, unprecedented swing. Where
a lot of ground to make up.
Lots of ground to make up. I mean, seats that swung 18, 20, 25%, phenomenal.
You would never imagine it.
So the seat that, that's right. Mm. I think anybody imagine it. Mm. So the seat that I'm running in had been held by Labor for many, many years. And it was at the last state election on a margin of 8% or 9%. Now it's held by the LNP at 9.2%. So I'm chasing down quite a big margin. Mm. So I'm not, I'm not making light of how hard the task is, which is why I'm saying I need lots of people, lots of people and lots of assistance to help. We hope that there'll be a bit of evening out of the swing that happened last time, and we'll see a bit of recovery around that. But it's all down to hard work and listening properly, and really listening properly. Not spending $6.1 million on a consultation that, that the state government currently has just concluded. $6.1 million they've spent on that. They called it Strong Choices, and they asked people to have their say about the budget. The results came back that the general public were not in favour of asset sales. But as we're told now, it was never a poll, and it was never anything that was going to...
determine government policy.
That's right. It was simply something that the government would be able to take and then, make their own decisions about what to do. And we've seen in the paper today that Tim Nicholls, our treasurer, has said that now the federal budget pretty much takes away all the options, and the asset sales is very much on the table, which we always knew it was. So that's one way you can consult.
There's always a reason as to why, or justification. I mean, Labor Party, you're lucky that we're not under Labor, because they would probably do this or they would probably do that.
Yeah.
I mean, what rubbish to try and assume what the other party might do with policy and with all this sort of stuff, and the Labor Party's create this massive debt, and all this sort of stuff. It's just, I got to congratulate you for wanting to go in the middle of all of this. I mean, I couldn't think of I couldn't do it.
Yeah, I'm not saying it's easy, let me tell you.
Just to put your hand up and have a crack at it,
But need mob to come out and help me.
It's just fantastic. Now, today's National Sorry Day. What does Sorry Day mean to you?
Sorry Day for me is kind of a moment to reflect, and in many ways, not to take away from how we celebrate Anzac Day, etc., but I always think of the words, lest we forget. That's how I feel on Sorry Day, lest we forget.
Mm.
Lest we forget the wrongs of the past, lest we forget the people who suffered under those wrongs, and, you know, lest we forget the past because we don't ever want to see it happen again. We never want to see that kind of business again in this country. It's not the kind of world we want to live in.
My guest is Leanne Enoch, for those of you that might have joined us late. And a cheerio goes out to Bumabipra Media up there in Cairns, Hopevale Mob up there, the Ribs at Hopevale, Burke Mob, what the mob name out there, Burke. Mob all around the country. Cheerio, warm cheerio to you all on this National Sorry Day. And tomorrow is the beginning of Reconciliation Week. And on Wednesday, we've got Uncle Conrad's case in there. But give us a bit of a background on stolen wages. Peter Beattie came out and announced $56 million for stolen wages compensation or repayments. Mm. It was a hell of a mess. $2,000, $4,000 offered. Mm. People got a lot of people were denied. Mm. There's a balance of some $20 million or so left. $22 million. Mm. That was put into a fund for education, the Queensland Indigenous Education Foundation.
Mm-hmm.
So it was like it was wages stolen again from our old mob, stolen a second time, because there was no consultation, no discussion or endorsement of that proposal by this time. I think it was Anna Bligh that did that.
That's right, yeah. So
where are we at today?
Yeah, so I guess, you know, to know what's happening today, we need to know what's happened before. And as most of your listeners will know, that you know, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander workers were pretty much controlled by the state right up until 1972. So all wages and savings were controlled by the state of Queensland. Young Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people were sent out to work from the age of 10. They recorded in all kinds of work, from domestic work to working on the cattle fields, to cattle stations, lots of different type of work. Those people believed that they were getting a wage, and what they did get was pocket money mostly, and the rest of the money was held in trust in Queensland. And for many thousands of people, those wages simply disappeared. There was no trace of where they went to. And so, of course, the late 90s, early 2000s, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people who knew that their wages had been taken or that had disappeared commenced litigation against the state. And in 2002, the state government at the time, that was Premier Peter Beattie, made an offer of $55.4 million. It was to be paid as reparations, and at the time, it was an acknowledgement that this would never be able to pay back all of the money. In fact, there are some conservative estimates that there was something like $500 million that has gone missing that were wages of Aboriginal people and Torres Strait Islander people. So this reparations was really about acknowledging what had happened and saying we can't possibly find all the records, we don't know exactly what's happened, but let's try and make amends, and this reparations fund was created. So the process for accessing those funds, unfortunately, the onus of proof was pretty much on the individual to prove that they had their wages stolen, or they had worked in a particular place where it was known that, you know, wages were being put in trust and missing, which meant that there were a whole heap of people that just didn't qualify, even though they know from their own experiences that they certainly did have money taken from them. So, yes, it came down to payments of $4,000 and $2,000. Back in 2008, I think it was, that maybe about half of the reparations fund had been dispersed, and there was about $22 million left. And at that time, the state government decided that it would be the best idea was to create the Indigenous Education Fund. And it was developed to create scholarships and other education type activities, you know, to fund that to help young Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. And you're right, those who had had their wages stolen felt totally gutted and felt like their wages had been stolen again, that they weren't able to access the reparations funds because the onus of proof was wholly and solely on them and they didn't have the pieces of paper to prove it. And so they missed out altogether. You know, you talk to kids these days who, when I say kids, you know, when in their early 20s or late teens, and they're starting to understand what stolen wages was about. And, you know, and I heard some young people 2 weeks ago say that they don't want their education paid for on the from the stolen wages of their aunts and uncles and grandparents. They don't want that. That was never... It's never the right thing.
It's a government responsibility.
Absolutely, absolutely. So around the same time, around 2008, 2009, Uncle Conrad Yateman, with the help of the Queensland Council of Unions, launched legal action against the state government to retrieve his stolen wages. Not reparations, but stolen wages. So that court case has been going on since then. Since 2009 was when his official papers were actually, you know, put in.
We've got to be thankful that he's still around to see this through. I mean, a lot of our mob have fallen along the way, have passed on.
Yes, exactly.
So we're lucky that Uncle Conrad is still here.
Yeah.
Now, what's different about his case? Is he putting the onus back on the government to prove
so
that?
Yes, so he is. That's why it's a landmark case. So he puts the onus wholly on the government to prove that they did not take his money. So, it, yeah, that's it's a very important case. The thing that this hearing on Wednesday is actually a pretty important one, because what happened at the beginning of this year is that the current state government. So let's just be clear that this is an issue for it's every government has had whoever's been in power. There's been some issues all along the way, but the current state government. Made an application to the courts for a permanent stay on all proceedings against them by Uncle Conrad. So basically saying, oh, you know, it was a long time ago, oh, memories aren't as, you know, clear and the records aren't that great. So, you know, really let's just draw a line under it and get rid of this and, you know, it should be over and done with. What we're saying, what the Queensland Council of Unions are saying, and the legal team that we've put around Uncle Conrad, and what Uncle Conrad's saying is that, no, we won't have a permanent stay on this. We will have the full court hearing. We're saying that the records are the human story is the record. And let me tell you very strongly, Uncle Conrad Yateman has a very clear memory, of where he worked, what time he worked, how long he worked, what he was owed, what he thought he was owed, and so. So, you know, I think this sort of saying, no, we won't have a permanent stay, we will fight this.
So is that the hearing on Wednesday to determine whether or not it will be a permanent stay or not?
That's right. Right, that's all it is at the moment.
Okay.
But it is an important one because if the state government wins and there is a permanent stay, then it's all over and done with. If Uncle Conrad wins and we get to go to the full court hearing, well, then we're on. Either way, either outcome... the Queensland Council of Unions maintains its stance in this on this position that we don't believe anybody, doesn't matter what culture you come from, if you've worked, then you deserve a fair day's pay for a fair day's work. So that's, you know, and really for my bosses in the Queensland Council of Unions, and I have to say all of trade unions in Queensland, this also, you know, goes to the question of dignity. Of human dignity, that, you know, you could have your whole financial base taken from you. You've been working since a very young man or a young woman, thinking that you're building your financial base and to have it completely disappear and to put you back so far behind everybody else and then be told, well, you know, it was a long time ago.
You know, how would those arguments hold up in, say, this big national inquiry into child abuse? Some of those people in there that are being accused or the allegations made against are old people. How would those arguments stand up? Oh, look, it's a long time ago. Maybe their memory's a bit faded and all this and all that. It just wouldn't hold up in any other court as far as, or any other inquiry. But the Queensland government's got to have the audacity to put it up. The other thing that's different, Leanne, is this is the first time a non-Labor government has dealt with it. I think all the time we've been dealing with this, there's always been a Labor government from Beattie onwards, and about five different ministers. I remember being a part of it and meeting with about five different ministers whose responsibility it was to tell us, no more claims, no more money. This is the first time we've had a non-Labor government.
Well, I have to say, you have to remember that when wages were being stolen, it was national governments and Liberal governments, etc.
Of all persuasions.
Mm. And when the wrongs were actually committed, it was during a time of Conservative government, you know, up till 1972, don't forget, where people were asking for their wages in the 70s and 80s, and, you know, doors were shut everywhere, every way along. The reparations arrangement, I guess, was the beginning of a different kind of conversation. And you're right, since the shift in conversation, this is the first time that we've had
back
to a Conservative government. And, of course, their first interaction with the issue is to have a permanent stay on Uncle Conrad.
Now, there's a rally on Wednesday morning.
So Wednesday...
Whereabouts is this happening?
So Wednesday, the hearing is in the district courts, in the Queensland district courts up on George Street. So we're having a very quiet, respectful, dignified, what we're calling a silent rally, and that's what the elders of the Stolen Wages Support Group wanted. They don't want a big rah-rah, carry-on, tens of thousands of people. They want something that's really about supporting Uncle Conrad and saying that we are all with you, and we're with you in a way that is full of love and respect and dignity.
So they'll have placards there with their little messages, short, succinct messages.
I should point out that the Stolen Wages Support Group is made up of elders who've had their wages stolen in the past and other supporters, including members of ANTAR, who've been amazing. ANTAR and Queensland Council of Unions have been working side by side with the elders on whatever, you know, what it is that they've wanted to do. So the elders out of the Stolen Wages Support Group did a bit of a workshop and said, these are the kinds of words that we want to portray to the rest of the world. So words like, there are some words that are like anger, like they're angry is one word, but there are other words like strong, resilient. Some have got sayings like about time. Those sorts of things.
Yeah.
So they'll be quietly there to support what Uncle Conrad says. We'll have an opportunity to speak to the press if they come along, Uncle Conrad, and Ron Monaghan, who's the Secretary of the Queensland Council of Unions, and I have to say, has been an incredible support for this issue.
He's been great, Ron. Yeah.
Right from the start.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's about social justice for him. So.
Yeah. So you're encouraging people to come along to attend the rally and sit in court if they wish?
It's an open court, so you can sit in court if you can fit.
Yeah.
Yes, come along. We're going to probably kick off around 8:45. But again, remembering that it's the wishes of the elders in this situation, that it is a respectful, quiet gathering, rally, if you like, and we'll take our lead from them on everything that we do.
Very good.
But yes, come along 8:45 on Wednesday, this Wednesday, outside the district court.
How can people contact you? Yeah, district court, George Street, city.
That's
how can people contact you if they need any more information?
They can contact me at the Queensland Council of Unions, which is 3010255. So 3010255, you can get a hold of me through there.
Good. Leanne, we're about out of time.
Oh.
Yeah, could go for another hour.
We could.
We'll get you back. Don't you worry. We'll get you back. Make sure you catch us tomorrow for your Let's Talk on your local First Nations station. You have a great day.